Okay, so you know all that stuff you sent us on memory in the brain, articles, lectures, all that? Well, get ready because this is going to be like your crash course in neuroscience. We're going to take a deep dive into how memory actually works, and hey, maybe we'll even find some tricks to boost yours along the way.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We always talk about memory like it's this like simple file cabinet in our heads, but like it's so much more than that, isn't it? It's way more complex and dynamic.
Yeah, totally. It's like way more than just like memorizing stuff for a test.
Right. There's so much more to it. And you know what? The stuff you sent actually breaks memory down into two main types, declarative and non-declarative.
Okay, so like, what's the difference?
So declarative memory. That's what we usually think of when we say memory, you know, like facts, events, things you can actually remember and tell someone.
So like anything you could explain to another person.
Exactly. Like what year was the Gettysburg Address? Stuff like that. Or how does photosynthesis work? That kind of thing.
Makes sense. So then what's the other one? Non-declarative.
Yeah, so non-declarative memory is more about skills and habits. We often call it procedural memory.
Oh, okay, I get it.
So think about something like riding a bike.
Yeah.
You just do it right.
Right. Or like playing an instrument. Or even just tying your shoes.
Exactly. That's it. You don't even have to think about it. You just do it.
It's like that muscle memory everyone talks about.
Exactly. And it's kind of wild when you think about it. Those procedural memories, they get so ingrained in our brains that we don't even realize they're there. They're just kind of running in the background,
Yeah.
like automatic programs or something.
That's pretty mind-blowing. It really is. And speaking of brains, I saw this one diagram in the stuff you sent. It was showing these place cells and grid cells. It's like our brains have an internal GPS or something. How does that even work?
It's really cool. So basically, picture this as you're moving around your environment, right? These specialized neurons, they fire in these specific sequences. It's like they're creating a mental map in your brain.
Whoa. So that's how we remember how to get places.
It's a part of it. But get this, those same sequences, they get replayed while you're sleeping.
Wait, really? So is that why I sometimes wake up with this random memory of a place I haven't thought about in years? Like it just pops into my head.
You know, that's actually a good chance that's exactly what's happening. Your place cells are working even when you're asleep.
It's kind of crazy how active our brains are even when we're not really doing anything.
Right. It just goes to show how dynamic memory really is.
So true. Okay, but let's talk about something we all experience, forgetting things. Because it happens to the best of us, right? Like, what's
Yeah.
the science behind why we forget things?
Oh, absolutely. The research you sent actually breaks down into three main types.
Three. Okay, so what's the first one?
The first one is called passive obsolescence.
Passive obsolescence, okay.
And it's basically just the natural fading of memories over time. Like imagine a path in the woods. If nobody walks on it, eventually it's going to get overgrown and disappear.
Right. Memories can be kind of like that too.
So it's a use it or lose it kind of deal. Exactly. Then there's something called targeted forgetting, which is actually fascinating.
Yeah.
This is where your brain actively starts cleaning house, usually while you're asleep.
So it's getting rid of all the junk.
Yes, exactly. Getting rid of unnecessary information to make room for new memories.
So it's like our brains are constantly decluttering.
In a way, yes. And then the last type is motivated forgetting. And that's when we try to actively suppress memories, usually unpleasant ones.
Oh, yeah, like that time I tripped and fell in front of everyone in high school.
Exactly. It's like you're trying to push those embarrassing or painful memories to the back of your mind, hoping you'll never have to think about them again.
It's like our brains are trying to protect us from those bad memories.
It's possible. And you know what? It's actually really important to remember that forgetting things isn't a bad thing by definition. It's totally natural and it actually helps our brains run more smoothly.
That's a good way to think about it. Okay, so we've covered the different types of memory, but this next part really got me thinking. One of the articles talked about this guy, Titus, who was wrongly convicted of a crime because of a mistake someone made remembering what happened. It made me realize how fragile memory can be, especially under pressure.
It's true. The case of Titus is so interesting and important because it shows how easy it is for our memories to get messed up or influenced by things, especially in situations where there's a lot at stake.
It's scary to think about, actually. If we can't even trust our own memories, then how are we supposed to know what really happened in the past?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's something that people have been debating for a really long time. It just goes to show how important it is to be aware of our own biases and to really think critically about the information we're taking in.
You're right. It's like we need to be our own fact checkers sometimes.
Exactly.
Okay, well, before we spiral into an existential crisis, maybe we should switch gears to something a little more positive. The research you sent also had some cool tips for improving memory, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. One that comes up all the time is spaced repetition.
Spaced repetition. Like, what is that exactly?
So it's basically about revisiting information at longer and longer intervals. So you might review something a few minutes after you learn it, then a few hours later, then a day later, and so on.
So it's like giving your brain little reminders so it doesn't forget.
Yes.
Not fair.
Exactly. And it's super effective for keeping information in your long-term memory.
Interesting. Okay. What about some other techniques?
Another really good one is called interleaved practice. Have you heard of that one?
Interleaved practice, not ringing a bell.
So basically, you mix up the subjects or skills you're learning during your study sessions instead of just focusing on one thing at a time.
Okay, so like if I'm studying for a history test and a math test, I should switch back and forth between the two.
Exactly. That's the idea. By switching things up, you're forcing your brain to work a little harder and make connections between different types of information.
It's like cross-training for your brain. I like it.
I've never heard it put that way, but that's a great way to think about it.
Okay, and what about this other one I read about, elaborative rehearsal? What is that one all about?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. So elaborative rehearsal is all about making connections between new information and things you already know. It's about making it meaningful to you.
So instead of just trying to memorize a bunch of random facts, you're trying to find ways to relate to them.
Exactly. Like you could try telling yourself a story about the information or coming up with a metaphor or even relating it back to your own personal experiences.
That's so smart. The more connections you can make, the easier it'll be to remember.
Exactly.
These tips are so helpful. I'm definitely going to start incorporating them into my own life.
I think you'll be surprised how much of a difference they can make.
I'm excited to try them out. Yeah. Okay, so shifting gears a little bit, I was really struck by something else. I read about how reading multiple books on the same topic is actually better for learning than rereading the same book over and over again. Why is that?
That's a great question.
Mm.
And it has to do with how our brains are wired. You see, our brains love novelty.
Novelty, like new experiences.
Exactly. When we encounter something new, our brains pay attention. When you read a new book on a topic you're already familiar with, you're bound to stumble across new information or a different perspective.
So it's like our brains crave that variety.
They do. And when that happens, it kicks off this process called synaptic plasticity.
Synaptic what now?
Synaptic plasticity. Basically, it means that your brain is actually strengthening the connections between neurons whenever you learn something new.
So the more new stuff we learn, the stronger our brains get.
In a nutshell, yes. It's like going to the gym for your brain.
I love it. So then this neuroplasticity thing, this is like the same idea, right?
Yes. Neuroplasticity is all about the brain's ability to change and adapt throughout our entire lives.
Even as we get older.
Yes.
Yes.
It's like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it gets. And this applies to our brains too.
That is so cool. So you're saying that it's never too late to teach an old dog new tricks?
You got it.
That is really good to know. Okay, so this is blowing my mind. We've gone from talking about different types of memory to the brain's ability to change and adapt. It's amazing.
The brain is such an incredible organ, and there's still so much we don't know about it.
That's true. And speaking of things we don't know, if our brains are so complex and capable of doing all these amazing things, then how does that explain consciousness? Like, how do our brains create the experience of being us?
Ah, yes. That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? It's what scientists and philosophers have been trying to figure out for centuries.
And we still don't have a definitive answer.
Not yet. We call it the hard problem of consciousness. It's a mystery that continues to fascinate and challenge us.
It's pretty humbling when you think about it.
It really is. Yeah. It just shows how much more there is to learn about the brain and the nature of our own existence.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to have to leave it there for now. But this has been an awesome deep dive so far.
I agree. We've covered so much ground already. From the different types of memory to the brain's incredible ability to change and adapt.
And we even touched upon the biggest mystery of all consciousness. I can't wait to see what other mind-blowing discoveries await us in the next part of our deep dive.
It really is amazing when you think about how our brains just work.
Yeah.
You know, they're constantly doing their thing, keeping everything running smoothly, like our heartbeat and how we process the world around us.
It's true. It's like having a supercomputer inside our heads. And speaking of things running smoothly, I was reading one of the articles you sent, and it mentioned this connection between the brain and the heart. Can you tell me more about that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So there's this area in our brains called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, or SEN for short.
Mm.
And basically, it acts like this master clock controlling our circadian rhythm.
Our circadian rhythm, that's like our internal body clock, right?
Exactly. And you know what's really cool? This rhythm, it influences so much more than just when we feel sleepy or awake.
Mm.
It also affects hormone release. our heart rate, blood pressure even.
So it's like our brain is conducting a whole orchestra of bodily functions.
That's a great way to put it. And what the research shows is that our heart rate and blood pressure, they tend to go up during the day and then down at night. They actually follow this circadian pattern.
Okay, that makes sense. Our bodies are usually more active during the day, so our hearts need to work a bit harder.
Right. But here's where things get really interesting. When that circadian rhythm is thrown off balance, like from shift work or jet lag, it can actually increase the risk of heart problems.
Wait, really? So messing with our sleep schedule can actually impact our heart health?
That's what the research is saying. It seems that having a regular sleep-wake cycle is super important for keeping our hearts healthy.
Wow. Well, I'm definitely going to be more mindful of my sleep schedule from now on. It's not just about feeling rested. It's about taking care of my heart.
Exactly. Speaking of the brain, have you ever really thought about the actual structure of it?
A little bit. The articles you sent had a lot of information about all the different parts of the brain and what they do.
It's pretty incredible when you really start to think about it. You know how each region has its own special function and how they all work together? It's like a perfectly orchestrated symphony happening inside our heads.
It's amazing and kind of overwhelming, to be honest with you. I mean, all those anatomical terms. It's a lot to take in.
It's true. The brain is incredibly complex.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a certain elegance to it as well. And once you start to understand how each part functions and how they all interact, it gives you a whole new level of appreciation for what's happening inside our own heads.
You're right. One of the articles actually suggested drawing diagrams of the brain as a way to help with learning and memory. Have you ever tried that?
It's a great technique. You know, when you engage different senses like sight and touch, it can really make a difference in how our brains store information. So by actually drawing the brain and labeling the different parts, you're creating a much richer, more multisensory learning experience.
That's a really cool idea. I'm a visual learner, so I might have to give that a try. So where should we start our tour of the brain?
Let's start with a region that's gotten a lot of attention in the research you sent, the hippocampus.
The hippocampus, okay.
Yeah.
Shaped like a seahorse, right?
That's right. And it's absolutely essential for forming new memories.
So it's like the memory processing center of our brain.
Exactly. It's responsible for taking new information and then transferring it into long-term storage. But here's something you might not know. It's also involved in spatial navigation. Remember those place cells we talked about?
Oh, yeah. Those are the cells that act like our brain's GPS system.
Right. Well, the hippocampus actually takes information from those place cells and uses it to create a mental map of our surroundings.
Wow. So it's multitasking. Handling both memory and navigation at the same time? That's wild.
It really is an incredible part of the brain. Now let's move on to another key player, the amygdala.
The amygdala. That name rings a bell, but I can't quite place it.
Well, think about this. The amygdala is all about processing emotions, especially fear and anxiety.
Oh, that's right. I knew it sounded familiar. Fear is a powerful emotion.
It really is. And the amygdala is right there in the thick of it, helping us to detect threats and triggering that fight or flight response.
It's like our brain's built-in security system.
Exactly. And here's where things get really interesting. The amygdala and the hippocampus, they actually work together. When something emotionally charged happens, the amygdala actually steps in to enhance the memory of that event.
That makes a lot of sense. We tend to remember things that were really scary or exciting way more clearly than everyday boring stuff.
Precisely. And that's because of the amygdala's influence on memory. It's also one of the reasons why traumatic experiences can create such long-lasting memories.
It's like our brains are hardwired to remember those intense moments, maybe, to help us avoid similar situations in the future.
It's definitely possible. Now, shifting gears a bit, let's talk about the frontal lobe. Have you heard about that part of the brain?
Yeah, it's the part right behind our foreheads, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a pretty important one. It's responsible for a lot of the things that make us uniquely human. Planning, complex decision-making, impulse control, all those higher-order thinking skills.
It's like the executive control center of our brains.
Oh, I like that. That's a great way to put it. And the research really highlights its role in abstract thinking. Planning for the future, making intricate decisions, things that other animals don't really do to the same extent.
That is mind-blowing. It's incredible to think that all of that is happening in just one part of our brains.
It really is remarkable.
Yeah.
And you know what else is interesting about the frontal lobe? It's not fully developed until our mid-20s.
Really? So that explains a lot about teenage behavior.
Exactly. Their frontal lobes are still under construction, which is why teenagers sometimes struggle with things like impulse control, making sound judgments, thinking about long-term consequences.
It's like their brains are still getting wired up for those more advanced functions.
Exactly. Now, moving right along, let's explore the parietal lobe. You know where that one is?
It's near the frontal lobe, right?
Yep, just behind it. And its main job is to process sensory information from our environment.
Sensory information, so like what we see, hear, touch.
All of that. It handles touch, temperature, pain, spatial awareness. It's basically how we understand where our body is in space and how we interact with the world around us.
So it's like our brain's sensory integration center.
Exactly. And it also plays a role in things like attention and language processing.
Wow, the brain is such an amazing multitasker.
Okay, so we've covered the frontal lobe, the parietal lobe. What about the temporal lobe? Where does that one fit in?
The temporal lobe, that one's located right below the parietal lobe. And it's basically our hub for all things auditory.
Auditory, so it's all about sound.
Exactly. The temporal lobe is where we process sounds, store memories, and even comprehend language. It's also involved in recognizing objects and faces.
It's like the brain's sound studio memory bank and language interpreter all rolled into one.
You got it. It's a busy place. And we can't forget about the cerebellum.
The cerebellum? Isn't that the smaller part at the back of the brain? That's the one. It's often called the little brain because it has its own complex structure. And you know what it's in charge of.
Tell me.
Movement. The cerebellum is vital for things like motor control, balance, coordination. It's what keeps our movements smooth and coordinated.
It's like our brain's personal dance instructor making sure we don't trip over our own feet.
Uh-huh. I like that analogy. And recent research suggests that the cerebellum might actually be involved in some cognitive functions too, like language and attention.
Wow. Even the little brain is full of surprises.
Absolutely. It just goes to show how much more there is to discover about this amazing organ.
Yeah.
And we can't forget about the brainstem. That's another crucial part.
The brainstem? What does that one do?
So the brainstem is like the control center for all our vital functions. Hmm. It's responsible for things like breathing, heart rate, sleep-wake cycles, basically the things we need to stay alive.
It's like the brain's life support system.
Exactly. Without it, we wouldn't be here. It's also a major relay station, sending information back and forth between the brain and the rest of the body.
Wow. It's amazing how all these different parts work together so seamlessly.
It really is a testament to the power and complexity of the human brain. Speaking of which, remember those techniques we talked about earlier for studying the brain, like EEG and fMRI?
Oh, yeah. Those were mentioned a lot in the research you sent.
They're two of the most important tools that neuroscientists use. EEG stands for electroencephalography. It's a mouthful, I know.
It is. So how does it work?
Well, basically, it measures the electrical activity in the brain using these electrodes that are placed on the scalp. It's like listening in on the brain's electrical conversations.
That's cool. So what kinds of things can we learn from EEG?
It's really useful for studying things like sleep patterns, seizures, other brain states.
Okay, so what about fMRI? How is that different?
fMRI stands for functional magnetic resonance imaging. And it's a completely different approach. It measures brain activity by looking at changes in blood flow.
Blood flow?
Yeah. So when a specific area of the brain becomes active, it needs more oxygen to fuel all that activity. And that means more blood flow to that area.
So it's like fMRI is a bloodhound sniffing out the active parts of the brain.
Huh. That's a great way to put it. fMRI is used for all sorts of research, studying cognitive functions, emotions, even consciousness itself.
That is wild. It's so cool how technology has allowed us to actually peek inside the working brain. Okay, so we've talked a lot about different parts of the brain and how we study it. But what about the actual building blocks of the brain itself? Like neurons.
Ah, yes, neurons. Well, the brain's little messengers.
I know we touched on place cells and grid cells, but there are tons of different types, right?
Oh, tons. The human brain contains billions of neurons, and they come in all shapes and sizes. Each type has its own specialty, you know, like different departments in a company.
I love that analogy. It's like a bustling city inside our heads with all these different neurons going about their business.
Exactly. So in addition to those place cells and grid cells that are crucial for spatial navigation, there are also mirror neurons. Have you ever heard of those?
Mirror neurons, not ringing a bell. Tell me more.
So mirror neurons are fascinating. They fire both when we do an action ourselves and when we watch someone else performing that same action.
Whoa, really? So it's like our brains are mimicking the actions we see.
Exactly. And researchers think that mirror neurons play a really important role in social learning empathy, even in how we develop language.
Wow. They sound like the brain's empathy cells helping us understand each other.
That's a great way to think about them. Now, let's not forget about neurotransmitters. They're the chemical messengers that neurons use to communicate.
Oh, yeah, I remember reading about those. They're like the brain's postal service, right? Delivering messages from neuron to neuron.
Exactly. And there are many different types, each with its own special delivery route and message to convey.
So what kind of messages are we talking about here? Give me some examples.
Okay, well, one that you've probably heard of is dopamine. It's often called the feel-good neurotransmitter.
Yeah. Dopamine is involved in pleasure and reward, right?
It is. But it's also crucial for things like motivation, learning attention, even movement.
It really is a busy little messenger. Okay, so dopamine is the feel-good one. What about serotonin?
Serotonin is another big one. It plays a critical role in regulating our mood, sleep, appetite, even digestion.
I've heard that low serotonin levels can lead to depression.
That's right, which is why it's often referred to as the happy hormone. A lot of antidepressants actually work by increasing serotonin levels in the brain.
That's good to know. So we've got the feel-good neurotransmitter, the happy hormone. What else is there?
Well, there's GABA, which stands for gamma-aminobutyric acid.
GABA. Okay, got it.
And GABA is like the brain's chill pill. It's the primary inhibitory neurotransmitter, which means it helps to calm things down, reduce anxiety.
Okay, so if GABA is the chill pill, what's the opposite? Like the brain's energy drink.
Huh. That would be glutamate. It's the primary excitatory neurotransmitter. And it's involved in things like learning and memory.
So it's all about balance, right? Like a seesaw.
Exactly. You need both GABA and glutamate to keep things running smoothly. The brain needs to be able to get fired up and also calm down when needed. It's all about finding that sweet spot.
That makes sense. This is reminding me of this other thing I read about, synesthesia. Have you ever heard of that?
Synesthesia. Oh, yeah. It's that condition where the stimulation of one sense can trigger an experience in a totally different sense, right?
Yes. It's like people's senses get all crossed.
In a way, yes. Like someone with synesthesia might see the color green when they hear a certain musical note or taste something salty when they see the letter A.
It's like their sensory experiences are all mixed up. That would be so strange.
It would be. And we're still not totally sure what causes synesthesia. But it seems like it might have something to do with unusual connections between different areas of the brain.
The brain is so weird and amazing. Okay, so on a more serious note, one of the things I read about that really stuck with me was Alzheimer's disease. It's such a devastating condition that affects so many people.
It really is. Alzheimer's is a neurodegenerative disease that causes progressive memory loss and cognitive decline. And it affects millions of people worldwide.
It's heartbreaking. The article I read talked about these things called amyloid plaques and tau tangles that build up in the brain. What are those exactly?
So you can think of those plaques and tangles like toxic waste products. They build up in the brain and disrupt communication between neurons. And eventually, those neurons can actually start to die off.
Is there any way to prevent or treat those plaques and tangles?
Unfortunately, there's no cure for Alzheimer's disease yet. But there are some medications that can help to manage the symptoms and slow down the progression.
Well, that's good to know, at least. It's important that we keep funding research to find a cure for this awful disease.
I completely agree.
It's really pretty incredible when you stop and think about it, you know? The more we learn about the brain, the more we realize we don't know.
It's true. We've made so many advancements, but we're still just scratching the surface when it comes to understanding this amazing organ.
I know. And one of the things that really brought that home for me was reading about the case of Henry Molaison. Do you know about him? He was known as Patient HM in a lot of the research.
Oh, yeah. HM's case is really fascinating and sad, too.
Yeah, it is. So for everyone listening, the research I sent you talked about how he had this surgery to try and cure his epilepsy, but it ended up causing some pretty severe memory problems.
Yeah, so as I recall, they removed a portion of his hippocampus. And that's what led to these really profound memory problems.
Right, and the hippocampus, that's that seahorse-shaped part of the brain that's super important for memory.
Exactly, and for HM, it meant that after the surgery, he couldn't create new long-term memories. He was basically living in a perpetual present.
That is so sad. To not be able to remember new experiences, new people you meet, it makes you realize how precious our memories are.
It really does. And you know what's really interesting about HM's case? Even though he couldn't form those new declarative memories like the ones we can consciously recall, he was still able to learn new motor skills.
Yeah, like that mirror drawing task they had him do.
Exactly. So that showed that procedural memory, the kind involved in things like skills and habits, was still functioning for him. Which kind of suggests that different types of memory are handled by different areas of the brain.
Right, it's like our brains have these backup systems for different types of memory. It's amazing. And kind of scary too when you think about what happens if those systems get damaged.
Definitely.
I...
Which is all the more reason why research into memory and memory disorders is so important.
Absolutely. Speaking of research, one of the articles you sent mentioned this technique called clarity. It's a way to make brain tissue transparent so scientists can actually see the neurons and
Oh,
connections.
yeah, clarity is incredible. It's like something straight out of science fiction.
I know. Being able to see the brain's wiring in such detail, it's amazing. What are the implications of this? Like, what can we learn from it?
I think we're just starting to scratch the surface of what clarity can do.
Yeah.
It has the potential to completely revolutionize how we study the brain. Everything from brain development to the progression of diseases to the very nature of consciousness.
Wow. It's exciting and a little bit daunting at the same time. Like, we're on the verge of these major breakthroughs in understanding how our brains work.
Absolutely. And speaking of how our brains work, one of the things you sent me talked about this thing called the default mode network. Have you heard of that one?
The default mode network. It rings a
It's
bell.
often called the DMN. And basically, it's this network of brain regions that becomes active when we're not focused on any particular task, like when our minds are just wandering.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So it's like the brain's screensaver mode,
Yeah.
but it's still active. It's doing something.
Exactly. We used to think that when we weren't actively engaged in something, our brains were kind of off. But the DMN shows that that's not true at all. And researchers think it might be involved in a lot of important functions, like memory consolidation, processing emotions, even those aha moments of creative insight.
So basically, even when we're just spacing out, our brains are still hard at work behind the scenes.
Pretty much. It's a good reminder to not feel guilty about letting our minds wander sometimes.
Right, like daydreaming is not a waste of time. It could be helping our brains to work through things and come up with new ideas.
Who knows what creative sparks might fly when we let our minds wander?
You know, this whole conversation about the brain and how it learns reminds me. We talked a bit about learning strategies earlier on. What were some of the key takeaways from the research you reviewed?
Oh man, there was a lot of good stuff in there. But one thing that came up again and again was the importance of active recall.
Active recall. Refresh my memory on that one. What is it again?
So basically, it's about testing yourself on material instead of just passively reading it over and over again. It's about forcing your brain to retrieve that information from memory.
So it's like lifting weights for your brain. The more you work it out, the stronger it gets.
Exactly. It's all about making those neural connections stronger.
Okay, so active recall. Got it. What else?
Another big one was spaced repetition, which we talked about briefly earlier. But just to recap, it's the idea that we should be spacing out our review sessions over increasingly longer periods of time.
So it's about being strategic with how we review information.
Yes. Our brains naturally forget things over time, but by spacing out our review, we're basically reminding our brains about that information right when it's about to fade away.
It's like we're outsmarting our own forgetfulness. I love it.
That's great strategy. And then another really important one is elaboration.
Elaboration, that's
This
cool.
is about connecting new information to stuff you already know, using things like stories, metaphors, personal experiences, anything to make those connections in your mind stronger.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Instead of just memorizing a bunch of random facts, you're finding ways to weave them into your existing web of knowledge.
Exactly. And the more connections we can make, the easier it is to remember something. And not just remember it, but actually understand it and use it.
It's like building a mental scaffold. Those connections make the information stronger and more accessible. These tips are fantastic. I'm going to try to incorporate them into my own learning for sure.
I think you'll be surprised at how effective they can be.
Yeah.
And, the most important thing is to be curious, to be engaged in what you're learning. If you're interested in something, you're way more likely to remember it.
That's so true. Passion and curiosity, those are the real keys to lifelong learning.
Yeah.
Okay, before we wrap up, I wanted to touch on one more thing. One of the sources you sent talked about the impact of technology on our brains. It's a pretty relevant topic these
It
days.
really is. We're living in a digital world, and it's definitely having an impact on our brains, both good and bad.
Right. So, what are some of the potential downsides that the research highlighted?
Well, one of the big ones is information overload. We're constantly bombarded with information these days, from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to sleep. And it can be really overwhelming for our brains to process all that information.
Totally. And then there are all the distractions. Like, I can't even tell you how many times I get sidetracked by my phone when I'm trying to focus on something important.
Oh, yeah, distractions are a huge problem, and they can really mess with our attention spans. There's also a growing body of research that suggests that excessive screen time can actually have negative effects on our brains, especially for developing brains.
It's kind of scary when you think about it. Like, what are all those hours we spend staring at screens doing to our brains?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. There are also some really positive ways that technology can impact our brains.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, think about all the information we have at our fingertips now.
Mm-hmm.
Or the way technology allows us to connect with people all over the world. And then there are all those brain training apps and games.
Exactly. Technology can be a powerful tool for learning and connecting with others. It's all about finding that balance.
So mindful engagement is key.
Exactly. Being intentional about how we use technology, making sure it's enhancing our lives rather than detracting from them.
That's such an important message. Well, on that note, I think we're going to have to wrap things up for today. But wow, this deep dive has been incredible.
I agree. It's been a wild ride through the world of the brain.
We've covered so much ground, from the different parts of the brain and how they work, to the complexities of memory learning and even consciousness. We've talked about the incredible capacity of the brain to change and adapt throughout our lives.
And we've only just scratched the surface. There's still so much more to learn.
It's both exciting and humbling to realize how much we don't know. It makes you appreciate the amazing complexity of this organ we all carry around in our heads.
It really does. The brain is the most complex structure in the known universe, and it's responsible for everything we do, everything we think, everything we feel. It's pretty mind-blowing when you think about it.
It really is, and that's why it's so important to take care of our brains, to challenge them, nourish them, protect them.
Absolutely. Our brains are our greatest asset.
Couldn't agree more. Well, this has been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for joining me on this deep dive. It's been a pleasure picking your brain.
The pleasure was all mine.
Oh.
I always love talking about the brain.
And to everyone listening, thank you for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed this journey inside the human brain.